tell you about Public Square. There are several lines that meet other edges.
You to this country who are already in a disillusioned, disenchanted state will be encouraged.
Where we talk about the fine margins. Sometimes it's black, white, and blurry.
It's also informed by the need to save costs and reduce legislative time.
Then there are the actors right at the center, coming through political processes, which could be dramatic.
To the extent of this abysmal, if Parliament does not raise this money.
And controversial.
If driving through the roads is a getting the macabre done, compatibility is that of government.
And there's you to help connect the dots from the top to the bottom. Join Rotimi Sankore and Arogo Obo at the Public Square every Friday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. 99.3 Nigeria Info.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is the Public Square.
All right, Shaku Maku, everyone. It's a fantastic Friday afternoon in the city of Lagos. It's been, drizzling in and out in the last couple of hours. But wherever you are, fasten the seatbelt, and we are set to roll together with Rotimi Sankore. And an interesting, great, intriguing guest we have today on the Public Square. This week in September alone, we have two big global education observances, and that's sadly have significant relevance for us as Nigerians. The first International Day for Literacy, observed on the 8th of September every year, which is just yesterday. And the second International Day to Protect Education, which is the day before yesterday, rather, the first one, from attack, observed on the 9th of September every year. And both are significant because, on the one hand, the Minister of Education acknowledges that over 60 million Nigerians are unable to read and write. And alongside this, thousands of students, especially those in the northeastern part of the country, have been abducted, and over a million school-age children displaced. So join us on Public Square today. We have the United Nations Children's Fund in Nigeria. Judith Giwa Amu is the Education Officer, UNICEF in Nigeria. She's National Coordinator Education in Emergencies Working Group. It's a pleasure to have you join us, Judith. And interestingly,
brilliant. It's also my pleasure to be with you.
Great. UNICEF been working globally for 75 years on behalf of the world's children. Another discussion with Judith Giwa Amu, who will have Rotimi come in, and we'll do some big picture analysis and do some compare and contrast with interesting countries like Afghanistan. It may interest you to know there could be things to learn from that one. And we'll have you join us in the square also too. So very warm welcome to you, Judith Giwa Amu.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. And we're streaming this live. It's on Facebook as well as on YouTube. Nigeria Info FM is the place to go to on Facebook as well as YouTube to follow this interview live. Now, UNICEF has underlined that one in every five of the world's out-of-school children is in Nigeria. What kind of impact do you think this will have on their future and the future of the country if this problem is not resolved urgently, Judith?
We know that a nation is as good as the power of its educated workforce. So, and we also know that the youth are actually they're the future of Nigeria. And we also know that education is the bedrock of development. The idea of education is for children and youth to acquire knowledge and skills and be able to utilize them meaningfully to contribute to the socio-economic development of the nation. Now, when you have an illiterate population, because you have over 10.5 children out of school, then no meaningful national development can happen. So it actually portends a very, very dull, very, very drastic future for us.
And indeed, real drastic future. If we think about Nigeria's median age, which currently stands at 18, and we do the projections, it spells doom, to say the least. But Judith, this week we also had the World Literacy Day. And in recent years, the Minister of Education, Adamu Adamu, has pointed out that at least 60 million Nigerians, interestingly, are also unable to read or Right. How does literacy in particular impact on parents and in turn the children's development, health, and their well-being?
Okay, so when a child cannot read or write, the child loses out on so many things. I give an example. A child that cannot read cannot even know the correct dosage of medication and can even harm himself. A child that cannot read or cannot, because we talk a lot on about literacy, but it's actually literacy and numeracy. And then we also talk about financial education. So the importance of reading and writing is so critical because a child needs to read to be able to be at par with its peers in other parts of the nation. We're talking of digital technology and all that. When a child cannot even, you know, go past the foundational literacy and skills requirement, then the child cannot even advance. The child cannot even aspire to, you know, really put his potentials to use. We know that children are a source of, you know, great potentials, innovation. But when a child cannot even read or write, he cannot even communicate his needs. The child even, I don't even want to, I want to look at it even from the self-esteem perspective.
Right.
When he sees his contemporaries, you know, being able to hold conversations very confidently, very comfortably, that child is already, you know, missing out. And then for the child to actually make it in the society.
Right.
There's no way he can do that without reading and writing. He won't go so far. He won't even be able to actualize his full potentials.
Absolutely. We'll not be able to achieve full potentials. In case you just joined the conversation today, it's an omnibus of conversation we're having with United Nations Children's Fund in Nigeria here. Judith Giwamu is the focal point for education here with UNICEF Nigeria. If you've got questions, comments on these two big commemorations, observances, which have happened this week, one with Literacy Day and the other with stopping the attacks on education in the country, you can send those comments on WhatsApp 0809-597-5805. Again, 0809-597-5805. And Judith, just like we pointed out earlier on, that yesterday was International Day to End Attacks on Education, and UNICEF, your country rep, Peter Hawkins, had put out a statement earlier on saying that we need to put an end to attacks on schools and students. In the global experience of UNICEF over the past 75 years, you've been working with the world's children. What do you think needs to be done to make schools safer?
There's, you know, making schools safer is actually a multi-sectoral approach. It's not just one sector that is involved.
Right.
And again, it's also something that needs to involve the whole society. So we're looking at schools. By virtue of their location, schools are within communities. Communities are the immediate gatekeeper. They are in the closest proximity to the school. So they are the ones with whom the children are, even before any security can come from the capital city.
Right.
So we need to be able to leverage on this partnership with communities, bearing in mind that they are the owners of the school. But basically, we need to be able to build their capacity to know, because we have what you call community-based measures. There are some things that the community can do. The community is the custodian of what we call the early warning system. Early warning systems are things that are put in place to ensure that the there's enough time, you know, for something to be done to ensure that, you know, the threat, the impact of the threat can be totally prevented or can be mitigated. So we are talking of early warning systems. We are talking of functional communication systems.
Right.
We are talking of risk assessment. Every school needs to have its risk profile. What do I mean by that? A risk profile will show a school to be a high risk, you know, and high risk could be a school that is very far away.
Right.
That, you know, will take like 1 hour for any support, any help to reach that school in the event of an attack. And then we also, so the risk profile is generated from a risk analysis.
Right.
The risk analysis shows the issues, shows the gaps that need to be addressed to make the school and the children in the school less vulnerable to attack. Mm. So for instance, a risk profile will show a school and, you know, like this school does not have a perimeter fencing. So it's porous because the walls act as the immediate barrier. Mm. We're not saying, I know even in the recent spate of abductions, we've seen where these abductors go through the wall. But at least as an immediate barrier, the walls are there. Then what are the entrance exits? How many entrances, how many exits? The staff, the security at the gate,
right,
has a background check been done?
Mm.
The teachers in the school, do they even know what to do? The children, you know, sometimes even confusion and panic, people die from confusion and panic. You remember in Afghanistan, because of the panic, they were climbing, you know, trying to board the plane and some died. They didn't even, they would probably not have, I mean, lost their lives if they had, you know. So that panic, you know, is something that needs to be avoided. If the children are armed with what we call disaster risk reduction knowledge,
right,
they can, that knowledge is, you know, is supposed to, it works to prevent or reduce impact of any effects of an attack on education. Mm. So the children need to have comprehensive school safety plans that are prepared participatorily with them. They need to know what is in the plan. They need to know, identify muster points, you know, where they can, what they need to do in the event of an attack. And these are things that they need to do in form of like exercises, simulations and drills,
right,
that will be reviewed, revised, and okay, what went wrong? Mm. What didn't we do very well? Mm. The idea of this is that practice. You're not waiting whether it comes. Just in case it comes, you know what to do.
Absolutely.
So that is one of the ways we talk of, you know, school-based interventions. So that is where that comes in. But by and large, we need to have, like, at the state levels,
right,
we need to have what you call like a coordination structure where, under which is domiciled safe school networks. The idea of safe school networks is that schools, maybe schools in one part of the state can benefit from what has happened so that lessons get learned, best practices can be, you know, scaled up to also ensure that the other parts of every state can also, you know, be protected so that the children are able to come to a safe and conducive learning environment, which is a requisite for learning to happen.
Absolutely, because I'm just thinking, when you think about the attacks that have happened in the Northeast and Northwest, and you sort of imagine if those children don't have access to the things you talk about, puts them in a dangerous place all through while they're in school. I'm going to read out some information here. This is an interview which happened with Premium Times, which is an online media, yesterday. The chief of the Maiduguri field office in Borno State, Fong Nguyen, stated that 1,400 schools were damaged and more than 1 million children forced out of school. And then 2,295 teachers were killed between 2009 and 2020, which is just last year. In the experience of UNICEF globally, what would you say is the sort of investment that needs to be done to deal with the damage that's happened, especially in the Northeast, which has taken the bulk of attacks in this more than a decade years of terror we've experienced in the country?
Okay, so there are several things that need to be done. First of all, we talk of having emergency-sensitive education sector plans. Mm. The idea of these plans is that ahead of time, every year, during the annual budget, some funds are set aside.
Right.
So that if it comes, you don't start grappling with, there's been no appropriation and all that. So that is one thing. And it actually filters down beyond the state education sector plans to the local government education sector plans. Mm. The local government education authorities are responsible for education in the communities where the bulk of the schools are. Mm. So the planning for this You know, it's something that we need to, you know, plan for over time. And I want to mention that there are some interventions in place with even UNICEF, the Global Partnership for Education, looking at building capacities of education functionaries. We're not even talking of only for education functionaries, because we know that, like I said, it's multi-sectoral. The protection sector, health, we had COVID. COVID is also, it's under emergencies. Water, sanitation, and hygiene. And then we also need security sector. So these sectors need to all be part of this capacity building, awareness creation, because they need to know the value of what their roles and responsibilities specify. So basically, these education functionaries, they need to be able to, you know, have capacities to be, to manage, plan and manage immediate and future shocks, future emergencies. So if they're able to do that, they can ensure that ahead of time, some of these things are prepared for, some of them are, you know, planning is done for them, so they're not taken unawares. So I think that is very critical, education sector planning. Then also we know that the education is on the concurrent list. So that means the state government determines what it prioritizes. So it the onus is on for the is for the state governor to actually, you know, recognize the kind of risk profile, the kind of issues, you know, that one that can expose the education, you know, sector. So when we say education under attack, we're talking of learners, we're talking of teachers, non-teaching personnel, and we're talking of educational assets. We know what state budgets are saying, and even though in the recent high-level meeting that was held in Abuja, I think on the 20th of April, where we had governors, governors from the Governors Forum, we had the chairman, we had ministers led by the Minister of Finance, we had the education sector led by the Chief of Defence Staff, the police, the IG. We had the private sector. And of course, we had the diplomatic community, including UNICEF and other organizations and donors. And, you know, in that particular forum, it was clear that the governor, the state governors have to take a lead. Of course, it would start from the national, because the overarching national school safety and security plan will be the source from which the state level should feed into, or feed from, And so if the governor is able to actually take that, you know, responsibility and say, look, these children, they have a right to education. I am the primary, the main duty bearer, and I'm responsible to support these children to actualize their rights to education under the Nigerian Child Rights Act 2003, under the United Nations Convention for the Rights of the Child, Article 28 and 29. It is their right. So how do we play our roles to ensure that they are able to assess their rights and achieve the Sustainable Development Goal 4, which is looking at education, inclusivity of education, is looking at quality education, equitable education for lifelong learning. So this, for me, is the assignment that the governor should be looking at, and also ensure that every key stakeholder that has something to contribute as a partner is brought on board, including the private sector.
Right, and you're going to expatiate on that a little more, Judith Giwa. In case you just joined in on Public Square 99.3 Nigeria Info, we have a special. We've rammed two big topics this week into one, looking at the future of education in the country. One, with the attack on schools and education system, and we read all the figures that happened in just Borno State, the one for the Northwest, I'm sure. But next year we'll have a clearer picture, but I do let you know that things are really getting out of hand, especially also into the northern western part of the country. Judith Giwa Amu is Education Officer, UNICEF Nigeria, National Coordinator Education on Emergencies Working Group. So why I said you're going to expatiate a little more on this one is you've talked about state governments. Would want you to do something for us. We have our own assignment here in 99.3 Nigeria Info. The Public Square recently launched the Campaign for the Future. 43% of Nigerians under the age of 15, incidentally, that's about 90 million children. And you've talked about child rights, protection and development. What do you think the local government, states, again, and federal government should do together to help improve the prospects of the Nigerian child?
Well, we know that I'm looking at the prospects of the Nigerian child with the foundation being education. Mm. In fact, the Sustainable Development Goal 4 is the pivot of all the other ones, because it takes a learned and educated female to go to school, to be able to grow up, support her family, to be able to have, you know, a very safe pregnancy through access to quality prenatal, postnatal services, to be able to bring birth and bring forth her baby safely, and for that child to be able to be free from immunization. Childhood diseases through timely immunization. So the role of education in ensuring that the children are able to grow up with knowledge and skills, and compete with their peers, and also contribute to the development of the nation, comes from what the state, the local government, and even the community are able to do.
Sorry to interrupt you, Judith, but we'll come back to share some of your experiences, you know, about what you've seen on the field. While we go for this quick break on 99.3 Nigeria Info, when we come back, Judith Giwamu will put finishing touches to many of the points she's raised on what the state, local, and federal government should be doing in improving the prospect of the Nigerian child. Please stay with us.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Public Square.
All right, welcome back. It's 4:30, well, 26 minutes going to 5, and I am Aogo Obo back to the Public Square. And we're still with Judith Giwamu, Education Officer, United Nations Children Fund, National Coordinator Education in Education in Emergencies Working Group. I don't know what the weather is like over in Abuja, but my gizmo tells me it's raining there too. It may be... It started raining. I think I sent down the rain to Abuja. I must begin work as the rainmaker. All right. Before we go off with you, Judith Giwamu, I'm sure that you want to put finishing touches to what you had to say about what the state, federal, and local governments should be doing to improve the prospects of the Nigerian child.
Yes, quality. I want to just give a little background. Quality education can happen when a child is in an environment that is conducive and safe. Then the child can concentrate. Mm. The child has, education in a classroom that is not destroyed, that has the requisite teaching and learning materials, and also that teachers. Because teachers are a very, very underlining factor. Mm. A child's education is as good as the education of the teacher. So if the teacher is good, the child will be good. If the teacher has been attacked and is going through some psychosocial challenges, the teacher cannot give his best. Mm. The child also, the concentration span of the child would be very, very little, because the slightest thing, because of probably maybe a past experience, the child will not be able to, you know, comfortably learn. Mm. So in terms of what the states and the local governments can do is to support as much as possible the school environment, the school system, so that it can be what I would call resilient. They need to build resilience in the school through training the teachers, so that they have capacity, they are not as vulnerable, and they are able to recover. Because that's another thing that sometimes might get lost. The fact that some of the abductees are returning, Every day I wonder at their psyche. I wonder at their social emotional well-being. Mm. Because some of those children, if we're not careful, are mad for life. Mm. They have gone through some kind of toxic experience that without the right mental health and psychosocial support services from counselors or for the very severely affected ones to be able to be referred to appropriate health authorities, it's going to be a tough one. Some children might not even recover. And you know, we're already dealing with over 10.5 million children out of school. So that is why you see some children, if you're not careful, they look at education and look at schools.
Right.
Schools as areas, zones of danger. These are schools that we have been saying that schools are protective, because sometimes you have this sexual gender-based violence and it's more at home. And some of the perpetrators are at home. Right. So school is protection for some children.
Mm.
When they come to school, they are out of, you know, they are out of the hands of some of these perpetrators who are relatives. So all of this, you know, it's like a circle. A lot of things affect a lot of things. But at the end of the day, you want children that have knowledge,
right.
Children that you can say are literate.
Mm-hmm.
They have foundational literacy and numeracy skills. They have life skills. They are able to make decisions that affect their lives. They can decide to say, okay, we want to go with education, and you know, that's the way to go. And then they are supported.
Right.
They are supported by the duty bearers. So the local government authorities, the state authorities,
right.
And even at the national level. Because we know that there are 104 unity colleges, the federal government colleges,
right.
They are also under Federal Ministry of Education.
Right.
So at the national level, those are the schools, and they have similar concerns.
Absolutely. We'll have to leave it at that, but thank you very much. It's been great speaking with you, Judith Giwamu, Education Officer, United Nations Children's Fund in Nigeria, the National Coordinator Education in Nigeria Emergencies Working Group. Keep doing the good work you do.
Thank you. And thank you. It's been great being on your show. Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. And we'll keep touching bases with UNICEF and helping us understand better how to overcome the educational challenges we face. Do have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Right. All right. So that's just one half of the show. We're going to go on a quick break, and when we come back, Rotimi is going to join us. When Rotimi joins in, we will have a big picture discussion, compare and contrast, and see just where we are on this education summit in the public square, 99.3 Nigeria Info.
Historically been apathetic towards the electoral process. There's no way for the youth to participate in mainstream fields like oil and gas, banking, and so on. The youth are actively excluded from those fields. And so we just created our own way in tech.
Informed analysis, reliable, accurate.
We actually advocate you get your eyes checked at least once a year. When you go for an eye check, the routine things they check, they do for you is to check your visual acuity. Visual acuity is how good you see. A lot of us don't actually know that we don't see so well. But because, like I said earlier, we can count money, we think we're doing very well.
Your number one station for talk, 99.3 Nigeria Info. Let's talk.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is The Public Square.
All right, and Rotimi Sankore joins straight away, host and development data expat, and we will continue from where Judith Giwamu dropped off. Remember that you can always join the conversation on social media at Nigeria Info FM, at Public Square NG, at Rotimi Sankore, at Awo Obo. Any of these handles you send questions, comments to, we will get them. You can also send them to our WhatsApp platform. Number on WhatsApp is 0809-597-5805. That's what we are going to be doing. We have two big issues. One was one which was marked, both of them marked this week on International Literacy Day, and the other one, the International Day to End Attacks on Education. As we pointed out, Nigeria, unfortunately, is linked strongly to these two discussions around education for the children, because even as we speak, there are children still in the captivity of terrorists in this country. Rotimi, great to have us talk about this very, very important developmental issue.
Yeah, I mean, in reality, it's sad to be talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, honestly, I would rather be discussing something else than, really such basic, really basic, developmental rights. I mean, it is always sad to have to talk about really basic stuff like this. However, if we don't talk about it, then it becomes normal. And if it's normalized and accepted, then all hope is lost for the country. I mean, we might as well give up and just watch the country descend further into chaos. So sadly, even though we're unhappy talking about it, we have to talk about it.
Indeed, we have to talk about it. So we got a number of talking points here. We'll go through them and hope that the listening audience will have to make a lot of sense out of it. Incidentally, this morning I was at some event on some software giant, and they were talking about artificial intelligence and all of that. And I was just asking myself that that's where the world is now, where we're still dealing with the basic things you talk about. So talking artificial intelligence and how to improve the system to be more resilient and creating systems, they're in a different world entirely.
The rest of the world has left us
indeed
behind. I mean, every now and then we are connected to it inadvertently, not because it's by plan or design. There's a young man of Nigerian origin that has just been shortlisted to join a space journey.
Yes.
He's going to travel by rocket ship into space.
Oh, whereas some people are still looking for the grazing routes by star.
Yes, so
cattle to work on.
Rotimi,
the impact of illiteracy on the ability to function in a modern society is huge. When you look at those numbers of people who are out of school and or being threatened because of the schools aren't safe.
I mean, somewhere towards the end of 2019, the Minister of Education announced that by their own estimates, about 60 million Nigerians are unable to read and write. I mean, that's a stupendous number of people not to have alphanumeric skills. Look, that is just slightly smaller than the entire population of the United Kingdom or France. And it is virtually double the population of Canada. So that just gives you, some idea of the scale of the kind of problem that we are facing. I mean, a lot of Nigerians want to go to Canada, yet we have a population unable to read or write that is roughly double the population of Canada. I mean, it tells you a lot about the potential future of such a country if things are not fixed. And at an individual level, really just makes it impossible for people to function. I'm really glad that Judith underlined that it's not just literacy, but also numeric skills, because the two go together. That's why it's called, alphanumeric.
Right.
And if you can't function, I mean, she mentioned just one little example, for instance, you are given medicine, you don't understand the dosage, either for you or your children. I mean, that's just really basic danger going on there. But in terms of functionality, almost everything you do now, you have to fill a form.
True.
So if those 60 million people are unable to fill forms, I mean, just imagine So there is COVID now. You want to take COVID, they say do online registration. First of all, the internet penetration is very low and then expensive. But if you can get it and you cannot read those forms, it means you are excluded. You are excluded just from basic health issues.
Right.
You are excluded from, I mean, you just name it, anything you have to fill a form for, or you have to read instructions, or, you know, turn left, turn right. You will just stand there just wondering, which way do I go? So there will be a lot of dangerous guesswork with dangerous implications, not just for you, but for a lot of people. I mean, can you imagine drivers, of which there are many, that cannot read or write? How do they understand the service manual for their vehicle? And your alphanumeric skills don't just impact on understanding. It impacts on your analytical capacity, your ability to compare things, to solve problems. And you are talking of artificial intelligence. The core of the future for those who are into futurism is problem solving, critical thinking. So if your ability for critical thinking is at lower than zero, because that is where it is, you can't read or write or compute.
Right.
Your ability for critical thinking is at less than zero. You can't even take one step forward. I mean, there are people you start having arguments with, and after the first two sentences they make, you are just like, no, I'm not part of this discussion. I'm not part of it at all. I mean, when Fela mentioned rougher fight, you know, that when the two of you enter inside the gutter and come out, nobody can tell the difference. That's where you are heading to. So when the government starts saying there is fake news on social media, there is this and that and that, it is mostly based on poor literacy. A lot of it is people not being able to compute ideas. Never mind summarizing those ideas in 240 characters, because with it comes summary comprehension. So when they look at something, they can't comprehend, they can't see the nuance, they can't read between lines.
Right.
And then they also can't rearticulate themselves in an equivalent way. So for a lot of those people, it is either this or that. You know, the two things cannot exist simultaneously. So it also leads to a lot of, you know, lack of cohesion, unnecessary conflict, a lot of prejudice, a lot of bias. You know, look, the implications for individuals are just horrendous.
Absolutely.
But even more horrendous for society, because alphanumeric skills essentially is the core of what is called pipeline planning. So any government that knows what it is doing at federal, state, or local government level, we know what pipeline planning is. That is essentially what kind of human capacity do you need for your society to function in the health sector, in the power sector, and so forth like that. And then you start your pipeline planning from primary, secondary education.
Right.
I bet you that the clear majority, and I'll be surprised if more than a handful of governors in this country, never mind ministers or presidents, forget local government, you know, those ones are almost completely irresponsible because, you know, it's either they've been disempowered or we are not disempowered, have no interest. The pipeline planning tells you, if your country is 10 million people, and out of that 10 million, 60 million are children of school age, how many teachers will you need from kindergarten, primary, secondary, and university? That's what pipeline planning does for you.
Right.
If a minister or a commissioner of education cannot tell you in 5 minutes that based on the demographic of their state, This is the amount of teachers they need in every sector. The guy doesn't know what he or she is doing there. If a power minister cannot tell you, based on pipeline planning, that for a country or state of X size
right.
needs electricity of X size to function, and therefore, these are the numbers of engineers, technicians, administrators that you need to service your energy mix, the person has no idea what they are doing there. So for society,
right.
this actually has huge impact. So you see right. people running for president or actually becoming president.
Yeah, Rotimi, let's go on a quick break. When we come back, we can have a look, you know, spread broadsheet, look at exactly why and how and what this means for us as a people, for the lack of planning and the consequences of 99.3 Nigeria Info. We'll be back with the Public Square. Please stay with us.
Tell you about Public Square. There are several lines that meet other edges.
Youth of this country who are already in a disillusioned, disenchanted state will be encouraged.
Where we talk about the fine margins. Sometimes it's black, white, and blurry.
It's also informed by the need to save costs and reduce legislative time.
Then there are the actors right at the center, coming through political processes, which could be dramatic.
To the extent of this disappointment, if Parliament does not raise this money,
and controversial.
If driving through the roads is engaging the macabre, is that of government.
And there's you to help connect the dots from the top to the bottom. Join Rotimi Sankore and Arogo Obo at the Public Square every Friday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. 99.3 Nigeria Info.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is
All right, welcome back. And we have from now till close to the top of the hour to finish and do some work with what we started earlier on with UNICEF. It's 3 minutes past five, and this is the Public Square. I'm Awo Obon. Rotimi Sankore is here with me. Remember, you can always join the conversation on social media at Public Square NG at Nigeria Info FM. Send us messages on WhatsApp, 08095975805. Again, 08095975805 for us to talk. Ruth, you want to wrap up on the point you were trying to make before we delve into the International Day to Stop Attacks on Education?
Yes, I was saying that in terms of literacy planning, education planning,
right.
that it is quite frightening to see the number of aspirants, candidates, or actual public officers that have zero understanding of pipeline planning for education and human capacity, which is why we now have 60 million Nigerians unable to read or write, and which is why many public officers from the top to the bottom cannot explain how many people they need in what area or in what sector. Hence, we have this absurdity in the health sector, where the Minister of Labour and Employment,
right.
who in fact, you have more data on this than you or I. The Minister of Employment should know. He should be working in such close tandem, not just with the Federal Ministry of Education, but with the state commissioners of education, that he knows how many people are being trained for which sectors and what the potential shortages are in terms of labor and employment. That is how on top of things the Minister of Labor and Employment should be.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the Minister of Labor and Employment cannot tell us how many doctors we need in Nigeria, to the extent that even though we have a shortage of over 450,000 doctors in Nigeria, should be just over 500,000. But he says we have more than enough. So these are the kind of gaps that happen when pipeline planning for literacy and education are absent. You know, the new Minister of Power, the first thing he said when he was interviewed is he's not a magician. Of course, we know he's not a magician. If he was a magician, he would be performing at the circus. Yes. But, you know, the basis for making that is he has no idea what he's going to do next.
Mm.
Because, I mean, you and I know that if some advanced civilization comes from Mars or Jupiter and gives us on Monday morning all the technology we need to meet our 200,000 megawatts of power,
right,
which is the minimum needed to run our economy and society, we will not have the engineers and technicians to service, to fabricate and install all those things.
Mm.
We won't have it. All that equipment will just be, remember when dozens of NEPA containers got lost in the ports.
Mm.
And even if that alien civilization installs everything for us on Monday, within 2 months, when it starts to break down, we'll have the human capacity to run it.
Mm. Mm.
So this, you know, this contempt for the education sector, this lack of understanding of how education integrates with a functional society or economy is one of the big absurdities of our country. So that is really the importance of literacy and education. And that is why no matter what happens, until we fix that problem, the future of the Nigerian economy is just simply not guaranteed. Mm. And of course, the negative impact of having over 60 million unable to read or write is the exclusion. They are excluded from the economy and largely from society, and therefore more open to misbehavior, whether as agberos, as bandits, as extremists, or just as non-functional individuals that you will explain, oh, can you help me do this and that and that? And after two sentences, they can't comprehend anymore.
Yeah.
Not because as individuals, they don't have the potential to understand, because we are all born equal.
Right.
We are all born equal with the same innate capacity.
Mm.
But once poor governance kicks in at local government, at state, at federal level, then the inequality starts to, you know, grow with it.
Indeed, starts to grow with it. And something which has grown, unfortunately, and the attacks have moved from the northeast to the northwest and north central. Attack on schools. Yes, this week we've also marked the International Day, observed also, to end attacks on education. And a very, very important question, Rotimi, we have to find the answers as we talk. One, which is, why is education under attack in Nigeria?
Yeah, well, I hope people understand that it is not a form of wickedness. The attacks on education are largely a form of social engineering.
Mm.
In other words, people that have interests to nudge the society towards a kind of backwardness that they benefit from launch attacks on education. So if you step outside Nigeria, for instance, and look at Afghanistan, the attacks of the Taliban on the education system, and especially on education for girls and women, is clearly a form of social engineering. They want to construct a kind of society that is beneficial to them, or that is at least not functional enough to go in a certain direction. So, largely speaking, that is why education comes under attack in countries, either due to ideological, cultural, or religious conservatism, or if you just like, backwardness.
Mm.
I mean, that's just the summary of it. Now, some of it is not just physical attack in the sense that children are abducted. Yeah, I mean, because if you look at in the Northeast, for instance, you know, I mean, the UNICEF report, also reported by a lot of development agencies, is that at least 1,400 schools have been damaged or destroyed. More than 1 million children forced out of school, children of school age. And the records that are available indicate that in the Northeast alone, 2,295 teachers, 2,295 teachers have been murdered. So you can see it is systematic. It's not just that the schools have been attacked, but the human capacity needed to train children, including next generation of teachers, have also been attacked. So you can see it's a form of social engineering going on. However, it comes with reckoning. So in Afghanistan now, the Taliban that spent decades attacking education have now captured the country. Now they have to run the country. The country now has to be functional. Now they are beginning to realize, I mean, it was a bit funny, I mean, really sad, but a bit funny. When the Taliban spokesperson then said, they will no longer allow educated Afghans to leave, because if educated Afghans leave, it will undermine the future of the country. I was like, So now they know. Now they realize that need engineers to run the power sector. Now they realize they need people that can read and write to run the ministry, to operate the financial system, the health sector, and so forth. In fact, a split is about to unfold in the Taliban, which may even turn violent. The more sophisticated ones that have been in exile, that have been in other Muslim countries like Qatar, in exile, you know, living in nice fancy houses, negotiating with the Americans, and so forth, suddenly realize that actually educated people are needed to function in society. The more backward ones, the rural ones that form their social base, are like saying no. So those ones don't want girls and women to go to school. The more sophisticated ones say, okay, can we divide the classroom? You may have seen it on social media. Yeah. I mean, this is why this attack on social media in Nigeria is quite absurd. Yeah. Because it just prevents people from learning quickly. So the Taliban, what they are now doing, especially in tertiary institutions, is that they put a curtain in the classroom. Then the girls and women on one side, the men and boys on the other side, and the teacher walks between the partition to instruct, learn, instruct, teach, and advise. And that is the kind of, you know, if you like, temporary agreement that is going on. They say that the transition will be that eventually, that if it is necessary for girls and women to continue their education, they will do it separately. But guess what? There aren't enough girls and women to teach them. So they are going to find that it is a clear impossibility.
Yes.
So all these things have consequences. One of the reasons why Northeast and Northwest have the highest maternal mortality, the highest child mortality, is partly because there are not enough women medical health personnel. Because conservative forces say they want only women doctors to attend to their captive wives. But guess what? There aren't enough doctors, and certainly not enough women doctors. So the social engineering, the negative social engineering of society has serious consequences. And these are things that people have to learn and be educated on before it becomes too late. So that is why the attacks on education are a form of negative social engineering. The social engineering also has huge bearing on governance, because the more poorly educated any society is, you know, the more impunity there will be in terms of governance, because most of society cannot compute budget. They can't compute policy. They don't know what you are doing. You can just come and make some small rants like that and they will just nod their head. But what it means that you can get away with almost anything. Almost anything. In fact, you will put the budget in the public domain and less than 10% of that population can compute the implications of what you have just said. So politicians, policymakers that are not investing, and this is a cumulative thing, because don't forget, as we've mentioned severally on this program, that at the height of the Boko Haram insurgency, 83% of all males in Yobe did not have access to education, 63% in Borno. And for each of those states, a higher proportion of women and girls were in that category. So what did it mean? It meant that only 17% of men and only about 12% of women in Yobe State could compute what the government was doing by policy or governance. So cumulatively for decades, they just got away with nonsense to the point where there were the same thing in Borno, and of course the same thing happening now in Katsina and Zamfara.
Right.
So essentially, the poor governance policy, you know, created a social base for bandits, extremists, or what have you, who now in turn are antagonistic towards educated people because some realize that educated people have helped themselves to the state resources, the minority of educated people that they can see in government. The appearance is that they've helped themselves to state resources. Hence the antagonism, which is being interpreted as being against Western education. But just put yourself in the position of 80 or 87% of poor people there. They understand they are poor, and the only people they can see enjoying state resources are those that went to school. And they are largely corrupt. So any extremists coming there can just show any mismessaging amongst them and then just, you know, do whatever they want in the place. So it has huge impacts on how the future of any society turns out in terms of peace and security, in terms of conflict. The sad part is that as far as gender equality and women's rights are concerned, that the more women are denied access to education, the more the reproductive and sexual health of women is weaponized against the society. Because it means they can be taken captive as children, forced to reproduce more. And in any context where there isn't enough investment in education, it just means more of a social base unable to read or write. So in Afghanistan, for the decade running up to the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, Afghanistan had more or less the highest birth rate in the world, the highest number of births per women. And it is all those kids now, at least a significant percentage of them, that have formed the social base for the Taliban. And you can see the same thing happening with bandits and extremists. Because in Katsina State, for instance, the age of, you know, of sexual initiation or sexual initiation is lowest in Katsina, and in Zamfara, it's about 13 or 14 years for girl children. They also have the lowest age for initiation of teenage pregnancy.
Right, right.
So all those things have a huge impact. Once they are denied education, the negative impact, you know, the amount of social engineering that you can inflict, negative engineering can inflict on any society through low intensity attacks on gender equality, women's rights, never mind the physical attack on schools and education, is really immense.
Really immense.
And what that means, of course, is that those societies essentially sink into poverty.
Right.
Because if you look globally and in Nigeria, the poorest regions, the poorest countries globally are those countries that have, that where the least amount of people have access to education, because the social mobility is poor.
Right. So Rotimi, a number of the places which you've referenced to in the country, places where we are getting an increase in the attacks, and especially in Kaduna State. Nasir El-Rufai, the governor of Kaduna State, was recently in hot waters when he talked about preferential treatment for northern students. And it got a lot of people talking. I don't know what you make of it. Preferential treatment implications for northern students.
Well, I mean, he's stating the obvious, but you could also say that the man is trying to be clever. You know, clever in the sense that he's extricating himself from the problem.
Right.
You know, but this is a historical problem, which if all of them had been, for instance, as vocal as even a feudal person like Sanusi, because, I mean, the contradiction of Sanusi, which is an interesting contradiction, is that even though he's from a royal family and had a feudal position. He was also one of the people that called the most for girl child education. That called for education. Why? Because he had the benefits of a good education. I mean, you can't go toe-to-toe with Sanusi and say, because he's a northern Muslim, you know more than him. It's not going to happen. He's, you know, he has excellent legal training. He has excellent economic training. He went to some of the best schools. There is nothing he will read that he cannot comprehend. So you see straight away that the stereotype that you are a northerner and therefore you don't know anything is not true. Once you have the opportunity, then you know as much as any other person. So, and that is why Sanusi, even though being a feudal emir, kept on emphasizing that education, especially for girl children, is the key to ending the underdevelopment in the north. So El-Rufai is late on jumping on that bandwagon. But specifically on the issue of the so-called preferential treatment, well, you've seen some people in JAMB coming out to say that northern students are not giving preferential marks. That's just a diversion. The issue is cut off.
Right.
And if you start from the unity school level, you will see where the governors and the local government chairs especially are complicit.
Right.
Because if the entry mark to a unity school, for instance, is, you know, 200 or 250 for students from certain states. We've seen all the public records now, Zamfara, Katsina, Yobe. It can be 3, 5, 10 over 300.
Right.
So, in effect, what they are saying there is that it does not matter if you fail. Just turn up and write your name and your exam number.
True.
And you are guaranteed, you know, entrance. And we have to underline that this is not the fault of the children. Because people often take out the antagonism on northern children. No, it is a governance issue. Because the governors and the local government chairs, having failed, and in many cases deliberately so, to invest in primary and secondary education, inevitably, the educational outcome is poor. Because either you don't have enough schools or the quality of the teaching is poor. Instead of improving the quality of the teaching, the quality of the schools, and the quantity of the schools, they then go and negotiate for lower cutoff mark, claiming that they are educationally disadvantaged and that if people from their geographic region are not admitted, then they will be excluded. And that's the point that El-Rufai was making, but did not articulate well. So he says it makes the children lazy. No, he's dumping on the children. Is not, are the children going to build the schools? Are the children going to train the teachers? Is it the children that will improve the quality of education? So it's not the children from the north being made lazy. They have not even been given opportunity. It is the fault of his fellow governors and previous governors in the northern states. I mean, let us even acknowledge that he has done a little for education in Kaduna State.
Has
he done enough to solve the problems that have been cumulative? And has he done enough to call out the past governors?
Right.
So, because if the 19 governors have come together and pointed out and say, you know, we have realized that since 1960...
Right, Rotimi, we have to go on a quick break. We come back and then wrap up and then open the phone line so people can call and have their say in the square on this big discussion we're having this week. Stay with us on 99.3 Nigeria Info. Let's talk.
Square.
All right, welcome back. And this will take us on the home run and retouch final base in the public square with this one, which means we're going to open the phone lines almost immediately for you to get your say in and for you to join in on social media, public square NG at Nigeria Info FM. Also, kindly send us messages on WhatsApp. I see a number of you already putting out those messages. We'll get to them in a short while. 08095975805. Again, 08095975805. And the number to call, 0700-993-993-993. Again, 0700-993-993-993. If you're female, you want to call in, easily. The number to call is 01465-7190. So, while we're getting the calls...
Yes, please. If I may just end on the point I was making.
Right.
Yeah, so I was saying that, you know, El-Rufai's statement that the lower cutoff mark or preferential treatment have made the northern youths lazy and therefore should be ended is misleading, because it is not the northern children that did not build the schools.
Mm.
It is not them. It is the governors, the local government chairs, that did not build the schools.
Mm.
So El-Rufai is indicting the young people. I mean, let me put it in stark contrast. Millions of young northern girls and women have been taken captive in the name of marriage, first child marriage, and denied education. Are we going to say that people that are captive are the ones that are lazy?
Mm.
That the cutoff mark has made them lazy. When in the first instance they are being prevented from going to school by individual men empowered by feudalism.
Right.
Feudalism which could have been ended by the governors. But they found it convenient to allow it as a form of bribery, using patriarchy to bribe individual men.
Right.
And when people like Sanusi point out the contradictions, they then dethrone him and accuse him of hypocrisy and say, after all, you are enjoying the feudalism with us. You are a prince. You are an emir. How dare you enjoy the benefit of feudalism and at the same time call for education for the masses, especially girl children?
Right. Right.
So what El-Rufai should have been saying is to acknowledge that it is because most of the governors, because not all people like Balarabe Musa, we are a difference to it,
but
the majority of the governors have run their state on the basis of feudalism and therefore have not invested in primary and secondary education historically.
Right.
Hence, the situation we have now in which they have a large social base that has not had access to education, has not had access to job skills, and because there is also a large hunger and malnutrition problem, the cognitive skills are poor, and therefore easily recruited by bandits and extremists. So there is nothing inherently or genetically wrong with people from the north, and especially not poor people. It is poor governance, and it is important that we recognize this, because if not, people buy into the stereotype that northerners are, in quotes, lazy, and it is now being promoted by El-Rufai, that stereotype.
Well, it's a great way for us to get to the phone lines. There are a number of people on queue now. Christopher calling in from Ikoyi. Great to have you join us, Christopher, this evening. Aha, Christopher.
Makushi,
good to have
you. Yala.
Great.
Sarotimi, good evening, sir.
Hello. Please.
I've been following you for the past how many years? You've been talking about specialist Zamfara, all these Kasida.
Mm.
The governor of Borno State, Sarotimi, is a professor, right?
The current one.
The current one, yeah. But all these things you are saying, how come they never listen? Even if it to get you as a consultant, you know, to put them through.
All right, thank
they will not. What do we call this? Is it wickedness?
All right.
Sarutmi, I just want to say thank you very much.
All right,
you're playing your role. Like I always say, to be a good leader, you have to be a good listener. But these people are not listening.
All right, thank you very much, Christopher. Pleasure to hear from you. Keep the calls coming in, 0700-993-993. On WhatsApp, this is Yomi Williams, who says, a newly appointed, he says, sanctimonious minister of power is telling us not to expect a magical power supply. Would rather want to hear his KPI with timelines for monitoring and evaluation. Nigerians aren't looking for magic, but a workable strategy in dealing with our challenges. While the Minister of Labour and Employment has never sounded scientific in addressing issues, Chief Rotimi is dealing with the real issues. All right, thank you very much, Yomi Williams. This one is Osisoma, who says, good evening. The challenge we have in the educational sector is mainly because of the discriminatory policies of government, which is skewed, unfortunately, in favour of a section of the country, he says. government must allow level playing grounds for all Nigerians. Merit must be given preference. Okay, we hear you. Back to the phone lines. I don't know why the calls aren't being screened, but we'll take them as they come. Hello and good evening.
Hello, hi.
Hi, great to have you join us. Your name, please, and where you're calling from.
Alex, hello to Rotimi too.
Alex, good to have you.
Yes, there's something we used to call mass mobilization for self-reliance
right.
and economic recovery. I'm sure you remember that program of many years ago.
MAMSA, yes.
Yeah, we've made many complaints about the docility, let me put it that way, of NOA.
Mm.
You see, many of the things that you have addressed, we are so far behind as a people.
Mm.
Yeah, Rotimi has outlined the number of people in our population that have never been exposed to formal education.
Mm.
Mass mobilization will help in this kind of situation because it's a way of, it's like carrying a whole net of the entire population along to be able to educate them. But we have a national orientation agency that does not see itself connected to any of the problems that Nigeria is facing today. See, we need that kind of orientation agency to make Nigeria believe in education again.
Mm.
And when we say education, we're not talking just about education in the classrooms.
Mm.
We have a mentality today that makes it look as if artisanship is a poor man's business.
Mm.
No. Many of these people that these Boko Haram and all these terrorist people are recruiting, they are people who could easily have been absorbed in vocational school.
Mm.
You know, the lady spoke brilliantly. The lady who spoke before Rotimi, she spoke brilliantly. But you will agree with me, Aogo, that fences and all those things will not solve our problem in securing the schools.
Mm.
There is no way we can achieve anything without the NOA being a critical part of what we're talking about here. Fences are not going to do it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Alex, for your contribution. Hello and good evening.
Yes. Good evening.
Great to have you join us this evening. What's your name, please, and where you're calling from?
Yes, quickly. My name is Ajimele.
Ajimele.
I'm reaching from Ireland.
All right. Go ahead, Ajimele. Yes.
Bro, Ago.
Yeah, we hear you.
I called based on the statement you made in your first interview with the particular lady you were like.
From UNICEF.
Having this conversation with.
Right.
I did not remember her name.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Minister of Education.
Mm.
We are like voicing out that so percentage of Nigeria youth can read and write. Mr. Ago, I keep telling you, you are a brilliant broadcaster. If I may ask you, who is that journalist that gave that man a mic to make such statements? Who is he? What is his role as a Minister of Education for him to come on air and make such statements? And you media practitioner, you were like trending with such words, even put it on air as a topic. I ask again, what is his role? Is he not the Minister of Education? Is he not his duty to like revamp the educational sector in this country? Bro, Ago, I don't know when he gets to a stage, a politician that's supposed to like as in manage or address a situation and propose solution on a particular portfolio he or she is handling. They will fail to do such things. They will still come and on air, will be giving silly excuses and they will still remain in that job receiving a lot of bungus allowances and salaries. And you media will even go close to them, will be giving them free mic, will be giving them free way to be making all sort of excuses.
All right, Ajimele, thank you very much. He could go on.
You and I at least just quietly exclude ourselves from this category of people we're talking about.
The irony is that Adamu, when he appeared before the Senate for screening, he was asked many questions, and honestly, I remember Ruth, he said he didn't inspire much confidence on how he was going to deal with the problems. You've thought probably after the first 4 years, his second 4 years, he probably would have a lot going for him, but it appears that he's if he's out of depth in terms of what he has
so
to
there
do.
There is a solution, you know, Alex, the lady before the gentleman was saying that MAMSA
Yes, ma'am, sir.
And I agree with her that largely we need some kind of mass mobilization. Maybe MAMSA can do sort of, you know, the information part, social mobilization part, but the investment has to come from the state governors and the local governments. There has been a suggestion put down about 2.5 years ago that in each of the 774 local governments that have between 10 and 15 councils each, and of course Lagos that has extra LCDA and so forth, that at least 10 literacy and skill centers should be set up in each council. And that if they take up 25 or 30 people unable to read or write a year on literacy and skills training, that over a period of an initially 5 years, that thousands will have alphanumeric and literacy skills. That investment has to be done at local government level, supported by the state governors, especially in the states where the higher percentage of the 60 million unable to read or write are. Now, note, the reason why I always talk about gender equality and women's rights is that a large percentage of those unable to read and write are women and girls. And it is not by chance. It is because they are specifically denied that opportunity, either through forced child marriage or boy child preference or other kinds of discrimination, which then deepens gender-based poverty, which in turn has a consequence on their children, because the poorer and less educated the woman is, the more chances that she will be taken captive and forced to have more children, thereby impoverishing herself and more children. And if she happens to die of maternal mortality after the 6, 7, 8, or 9 child, the guy just discards the children and gets another girl. So unless the policy takes all these things into account and the investment takes all these things into account, because first of all, the girls have to be freed from captivity to go to the literacy school, which means the policy has to state that the individual men that have taken them captive, empowered by the patriarchal state governments, need, you know, they need to free them. And it has to be a matter of policy. If not, the men will just feel that, well, if the state empowers me to abuse the girls, then why should I let them to go to school so that they will have education and skills and can talk back? You know, and then gain skills and income for themselves. So it's not just that the mass mobilization has to be done. The, you know, that bondage has to be broken, because the majority of people we are talking about are girls and women.
Oh, right. So let's get back to the phone lines. 0700-993-993-993. Got the number of calls. Let's see this one. Hello and good evening. Hello and good evening.
Hello, Shaku Maku.
Hey, Makushi. All right, go ahead quickly. What's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Kunle Major from Festac.
Kunle Major from Festac. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good evening.
Evening.
Good evening, Uncle Rotu, Mr. Kore.
Hello, good evening.
I follow your program regularly. I'm impressed at the way you were enlightened, you know. That's why I called. That's the reason I called for today. And Shaku, I'm Festac.
I will come to Festac now and again. I do come to Festac. All right. Ahmed says, I wish Sarotimi becomes a political consultant to our rogue politicians.
Oh,
it's a great wish.
Let me just say something, please. A lot of these guys, I went to school with them. I'm not going to be a consultant to them. If I want to be a politician, I'll find a political party that has the
ideology that is compatible with my thinking, and I will run for the position myself. Why should I be a consultant to an incompetent politician that I know?
Okay. Adesoji Adekola from Barua in Ikpaja says, I like the way he spells my name. He's just a ho-ho and wrote to me Sankrid on public square. My Friday is not complete without listening to your program. In particular, I always enjoy the submission of Ruth Moon, any issue discussed. If we are to use parameters of pipeline planning as discussed and explained by Ruth Moon, I doubt if any of our federal ministers deserve to remain in office by next Monday. The lack of effective planning in all our sectors has brought the country to its knees. Where is it today? Pathetic state. It says there's some programs that are supposed to be discussed on TV, and this show is one of them. I don't have your name, but he says, the caller is speaking my mind. Media practitioners should find a strategic way to shut these government officials and stop headlining the rubbish things they say. We want to read and see the journalists, ask them how they make such a statement. You see, national media in the US and UK say, you say rubbish and media can make you lose your job. We should get that level of journalism in Nigeria. I hear you.
Yeah, but what does that guy think you and I are doing here? why does he think you and I are not running for governor or want to be ministers?
Onoha from...
That's why I tell answer. People, when they say you should be in government, I say, no, we need a strong media.
Exactly.
We need a strong media. Why should we be in politics to make an impact when we can be in the media and do the constitutionally mandated work of the media, which is to promote education, awareness, and accountability?
Suraju Olubiyo says, Rosemary, please, can I ask where you're from? Your analysis is top-notch.
What does origin have to do with it?
Okay. This is Onoha from Berger. He says that... Mr. Sankore will not kill you. I really hear people like you speak on issues. I feel proud as a Nigerian that we still have intelligent people around. I wish these our leaders would listen to sound minds like you. Northern leaders are the architect of their problems and they pretend not to know. Onoha, thank you for your message. Maybe we'll get back to the phone lines. Take one more call before we go off because we are out of time. Hello, and good evening.
Can I just make one?
Hello and good evening.
We should move away from this state of origin and deal with state of residence.
Hello.
Exactly.
This is why Nigerians go to America and become advisors or
just hold on,
members
please. Right.
Of President Biden.
Right.
And nobody is saying...
All right, so sorry about that. Okay. So we had some technical wahala there. Oh yeah, Ruthmi. I think I'm not sure we can squeeze in that one more call yet, but let's try one more and then see if. Hello and good evening.
Hello.
Great to have you join us. Your last call on Public Square this evening.
Good evening.
Good to have you. What's your name, please, and where are you calling from?
Julius from Aja.
Julius, please go ahead.
Great man. God bless universal primary education that was done in the early 80s. Mm. I'm saying this because my mother is a beneficiary. That after having 6 children, she has to go to education, the UPE education that was established that time. And pursue her career to where she worked and retired. I'm very proud of it today. Education cannot be neglected if you want to make progress.
Right.
I agree with your analysis of Naruto Sankore. And I pray one day, everybody will realize that this is the way to go. If we remain illiterate, we will never progress.
Right. Thank you.
Calling you today is just to make sure that how we can strengthen this mass education program.
Absolutely.
We need mass education in Nigeria.
Mm.
And that is the only way we can progress our future.
Absolutely, and a great way for us to end the conversation, Julius. Thank you very much. Thank you for the messages. Chinedu Ayobo, we see your message. He said he thought GSS in Borno State, as a core member, during the census, he discovered something shocking. Half of the children he taught in school were actually married. Most of the young girls are enumerated were either married or divorced, and their third divorce. Onoha Chinedu from Ayobo, thank you very much. So, Rotimi, we're out of time.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing more to say except join us next Friday on Public Square 99.3. Mm. It's going to be a big edition. Mm. It's going to focus on the International Day of Democracy, which is next week.
Right. Okie dokie.
So 4 p.m. next week, Friday.
All right. We'll be here. 99.3 Nigeria Info, and do have a great weekend. We're going to go on a quick break. When we come back, it'll be the news at the top of the hour. 99.3 Nigeria Info, the many stories breaking. You should stick with us at the top, and even after, to hear Music and Moments with Sammy and Ifeanyi. Please stay with us on 99.3 Nigeria Info. Let's talk.